So then we come to the fifth aggregate, that of consciousness, which in Latin means to know with. And I can't help but to keep thinking about compassion, to suffer with. I would like to believe, or I feel, that there's something wonderfully intimate about, or connected between, a sense of consciousness and compassion. And for right at this moment, one of the links is the word con, in the front, the prefix. The idea of being with our knowing, being with our empathy, being with others, being with ourselves, this being with our lives, being connected, being with ourselves so we're at home, our hearts are at home in themselves, our minds are at ease, at peace. And I hope that this exploration of ourselves, our practice, our lives together, is a field of consciousness, field of knowing with. Apparently the word in Latin, consciousness, the root of it, seemed to have meant something with two people knowing something together. So it really meant interpersonal knowing. We don't want to go too far along these lines, but I like this idea of with. We have exploring this field of our lives together, what it means to be alive, what it means to be a person, what it means to know. And consciousness is this wonderful quality. For those who are in touch with it, those who really have a strong sense of their consciousness, generally, it's kind of a very special, very wonderful, and fairly mysterious, because it seems that no one knows what it is. And if they do know, I probably don't trust them. And I used to be somewhat self-conscious or a little bit insecure about not knowing what consciousness is. You know, I'm a Buddhist teacher, I should know. But I don't even know what mindfulness is. So, I better not tell you the first day of the retreat. But I feel less insecure because I've talked to other teachers and I've read a little bit about psychologists and scientists trying to understand what consciousness is. And it seems like one of the most common things that people say about it, my reading at least, is that we're not really sure what it is. We don't know what it is. There are all kinds of theories. People have theories. And at the same time, it can seem such a special quality. So it is one of the aggregates, at least the Pali word vijnana is usually translated as consciousness, sometimes translated as discernment. And what it even is in Pali, what vijnana is not really clear to me. You know, I've tried to study this, I've looked into it, and I could point you to particular passages in the suttas where the Buddha kind of defines what vijnana is, consciousness is, and it doesn't help me to understand it. Maybe I'm not sure what it is. And it's partly because the word is used in many different ways in the text. And so we have to kind of then consider the context in which it's taught and what it means. Sometimes it seems that what scholars say is that the word vijnana sometimes is a synonym with other words related to mind, like manas and citta. So it's, you know, and maybe the point is not to know what it is. Maybe it isn't something that is. Isn't that nice? Wasn't it some famous person who said, what do you mean by is? Was he a Buddhist? The Buddha? What do you mean by is? Is. Is consciousness an is? In the sense that is it a noun? Is it a thing that can be identified as being a thing and then you get a definition for it? It seems that when the Buddha wanted to explain all the aggregates, he did so as functions, as activities, as processes, rather than as things. And so consciousness as well is not a thing, so it kind of, you can't quite pin it down as a thing. It's a process, or maybe a series of processes. One idea in the suttas is that we have six different kinds of consciousness, one for each of the senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue. And sometimes it's quite a delightful thing, or quite powerful to get a sense of, you know, there's hearing and there's the knowing of that hearing. There's tasting and the knowing of the tasting, seeing and the knowing of the seeing, touching and the knowing of the touching, smelling and the knowing of the smelling, and then mental activities and knowing of the mental activities. And it seems that, you know, each of those is seen as a kind of consciousness, kind of a knowing. And to see them as distinct is quite interesting because it begins to tease apart, distinguish a little bit more the underlying structure of our experience. And to see the structure of our experience below the generalizations of concepts and ideas we have is one of the ways to help us not to cling, to free up a little bit. And so as we've said, the five aggregates is one of these ways to begin looking a little bit under the surface of the generalizations we make about our lives and about ourselves. See, what are we actually made up of? Or what are the underlying experiences or processes that we kind of, that are operating or we can feel or experience? When I was in Burma, practicing there after some months of practicing, well, pretty much every day I would go for an interview with the teacher, and we would go into his front room in his house, and he would be sitting on his chair, and we would come in, and we would go in through the door, and just to the right there was a little altar, and then we walk into the room and do our bows and sit in front of him and do our interview. And mostly what he told me was carry on. Seemed like that was the most, you know, the most common, you know. We had a lot of interviews. Carry on. But I took that as a compliment, because some of the alternatives were not as... So one day I was coming in for my interview. So I went, walked through the door, and remember the altar's there on the right, and somehow I glanced at the altar, and I saw in rapid succession, I had a perception, I saw a feeling that perception elicited in me, and I saw the arising of a desire, which is the form was the form of a Buddha image, Buddha statue, that hadn't been there before, suddenly new. The feeling was pleasure. There was a perception, this is a Buddha, and some of the associations, what a Buddha means for me. And then there was desire, I want that Buddha. You know, normally it would have happened, you know, in an instant. And all I'd be left with was, I want that. You know, this process leading up to that, I wouldn't have seen. And it was quite something to see the process leading up to it, to see this, the conditionality from one going to the other. And it took some of the power out of the desire. it kind of saw desire just became one more piece of the cascade, of the kaleidoscope, of the kind of the rainbow colors, stripes of the rainbow or something, of the mirage or something, just like one more thing. And in seeing it in such rapid succession, seeing how they built on each other or formed each other, I saw the desire is just, you know, it was nothing that I needed to do it or act on, or it didn't stay anywhere. It was just kind of like Teflon mind, you know, just went. So that was nice. It was great. That was one of those. It was a great lesson for me in seeing, kind of like the aggregates, and seeing how our experience is made up of different things. And if you can catch the different things as they're made up, there's much more freedom in it all. So consciousness is required to be aware of the other four aggregates. In one teachings in the Buddha, that consciousness is shaped by the mental formations, by sankharas. So there's something about the way that we know which is biased. The way that we know is selective. The way that we know is shaped by our intentions, our desires, our preferences, our all kinds of things. As I've told this many times, but you know, when I was on the shopping for couches, I think a futon couch, I was surprised how many couch and futon stores there were in town. I had no idea. I never noticed them before because they weren't, you know, but when I had desire for couches, then my desire was selective. When I was 17, my attention was selective for certain segments of the population, what I would notice. Let you figure out what, you know, various, you know, so we have this consciousness of what we know or how we know. So I don't know what consciousness is, but it is possible to become aware of being aware, aware of knowing, the process of knowing. And in my conversations with people over time and hearing how they know, if you ask people, what does it feel like to be aware? What happens to you when you're aware? You'll get a range of answers from people. And I kind of think that there's different ways in which people know. And we want to be very careful not to think there's one way that you're supposed to be, how you're supposed to know and know things. Maybe there's many ways knowing. So as I talk about consciousness today, I hope that you don't take me too seriously if it doesn't fit how it works for you. But it's the principle underlying all this that's important. And the principle is that the teachings on the aggregates are closely connected to the Buddha's teachings on the upadana khandhas, the aggregates of clinging, the clinging aggregates. So it's not just a matter of understanding the aggregates, but it's also understanding that in relationship to these aggregates, we cling. In fact, the primary definition of the First Noble Truth is, that kind of reference point for understanding them, is the five clinging aggregates. And I think you, without too much analysis, you know that people cling to their body, their appearance, what goes on here. And people cling to the first aggregate. People cling to the second aggregate. They cling to pleasure and comfort. Or they have reverse clinging, aversion to displeasure or the unpleasant or the uncomfortable. Some people have very strong attachments to their perceptions or their views of how things are. They see things a certain way, it has to be that way. And so sometimes connected to being right or wrong. the attachment to views, perceptions. And, you know, in the world of mental formations, I mean, that's a huge universe. There can be a lot of attachment there, and attachments to what we want, attachments to what we don't want, attachments to what we think, attachment to our stories, our opinions of all kinds, attachment to our memories, attachment to our suffering. The Buddha said, it's a very interesting statement, he said, something like, if you really see how impermanent things are, you will not be attached to suffering. When I first saw that, I said, what? Attached to suffering? But in fact, sometimes we're attached. Sometimes suffering is comforting. It's sometimes suffering is where we build up our sense of security, our sense of self, our sense of knowing how to orient ourselves to the world. And so it's not easy to let go of suffering if suffering has all these important functions for what we think is our well-being. And so sometimes it's necessary to look to how we're attached to suffering. So the aggregates, you know, so the fourth aggregate, you know, is the world of attachment. And so then we come to consciousness, and this also can be an area of attachment, of clinging. And that's one of the reasons to study these aggregates is to understand, be sensitive to how we cling, how we attach, how we grasp to them. And so to understand consciousness or knowing, the principle is we understand not so much what consciousness is, but we understand how we get attached to what we think consciousness is. If your mind operates in a particular way of knowing, you know things, the world in a certain way, that's your way to know, great. You can rest, that's enough to know your way. But then you want to understand, how is it that you get caught up and tangled in that consciousness? And how is it that understanding consciousness and appreciating it and paying attention to it can help free you, loosen you up, help you relax and open up? As a form of clinging, I think I'm familiar that the place where humans get most attached to consciousness is when they do spiritual practice, when they do things like meditation. Because then some feeling or sense of awareness or consciousness begins to become stand out in highlight. And as it stands out in highlight, then it starts having more value, it feels good, it feels ultimate, it feels all kinds of things. So then we become attached to it. We hold on to it. So what is awareness, consciousness, knowing? One of the ways that I understand it, you know, and again, not to understand it as a thing, but I understand it as being something that's very fluid, malleable. Because it's not a thing, it's kind of like water that takes the shape of any container you pour the water into. Or maybe more like air that you can't even see. But I guess air takes the shape of any container you put it into, right? But it's, you know, it does, you know, I guess. I mean, you know. So consciousness or awareness kind of takes a shape. And it's very malleable. The sense of what it's like to be aware, how to be aware, can change in a fluid way. So what I'm about to say, maybe you can feel your way into and see if this, you can see if it relates to your experience. So you can take your awareness and you can move it around. You know, you could decide to, you know, to look at the ceiling and start counting the holes in the panels up there. You can choose to do that. You move your attention up, you know, away. The number of holes is more interesting than Dharma talk. So you take your awareness and you start counting. So you can, or you take your attention and you have pain in your knee, and you bring your awareness and you place it in your knee. You can take your awareness and you can choose to have different distances from what you're aware of. Sometimes you can place your awareness in the middle, especially in your body, but in the middle of the knee. Just really feel it from the inside. And sometimes you can pull back and be a very detached observer, like you're far away looking down at the knee or looking down at yourself. And this fluidity of being able to move in and out, closer and further away, is a very helpful skill. Because some things it's useful to really be intimate with and really connected and kind of lose yourself into, even sometimes become one with. Awareness kind of gets absorbed in. And sometimes that's not useful. And sometimes what's useful is to be really far back observer. Very strong emotions sometimes, fear and anger, that we identify very strongly with, are very troubling and challenging. Sometimes it's very helpful sometimes to imagine you're up on a hill behind you, the mountain behind you, you know, and the jet high up in the as far away as you can. And then you can look at it in a kind of more equanimous way. But if you get really close to the fear, it just kind of makes more. So some people learn to kind of adjust how close they get, how far away they are to the experience. You can use awareness and have it very narrow. And so you can just look down, like kind of like a laser maybe, or kind of like pinpoint something. You can really get right down into, you know, the actual, you know, cell that's it having the itch. Maybe just really fine detail. Or you could kind of do a sweep and kind of be aware of a wide area and just kind of let it all kind of show itself and reveal. Kind of wide angle lens, close-up lens. That language is often used by Vipassana. Take your awareness and adjust it in some way. It can feel very constricted, you know, if you have if you're really troubled by something really difficult has happened in your life, big conflict or something, and suffering or something, and you're really preoccupied, and you can kind of feel that your kind of awareness gets claustrophobic, tight and constricted, and can't really pull out and see very much, just so drawn in. And other times awareness just seems so spacious and open. You've had a nice nap, you've had a nice walk, had a nice picnic lunch, and had laid down under the oak tree, beautiful up in the hills, beautiful vista. You wake up from this wonderful nap, and it was a perfect nap. You wake up crystal clear, and you look out and you see the rolling hills and the sky, and it just feels like, you know, there's the consciousness, the awareness is just broad and open, almost like as open or wide as the space itself all around you. It just feels like awareness is open, wide. Awareness sometimes can feel noisy, busy, agitated, all this stuff. And sometimes it can feel completely still and stopped. And maybe you've had the experience in your life. There's a number of things in ordinary life that can change your consciousness very quickly. You know, you could be driving your car and merrily being neurotic about something, concern and thinking about it, whatever you think about, and minding your own business, and caught up in some preoccupation. And then you can be in a near accident. Or maybe an accident even. You come out uninjured, but pretty dramatic. Even a near accident. And then, boom! I mean, like day and night, right? Between, you know, going around and listening to your chatter, and boom! Wow, I could be dead. Or wow, you know, just everything comes completely still. Or maybe very spacious, open, quiet. There's some thinking maybe going on now, but it's this wider field of quiet. So what I'm trying to convey is that awareness is malleable, shifts and changes. Sometimes we can have a sense that it just arises and passes with each sense. Sometimes you have a sense, feel a kind of an intuition or sense that it's like this field of like a screen almost, or a field within which things arise and pass. So rather than there being sound and sound consciousness, hearing consciousness, it's more like there's a field of consciousness that sound arises within. It can feel very kind of like this big thing all around. Is what we're experiencing, are any of our experiences the truth about consciousness, truth about awareness? Now I know what awareness is. Awareness is spacious and open and still. Awareness is a field. Awareness is momentary and rises and passes. Are any of these true? What is, we don't know what awareness is. I don't know. But what we can know, and I think this is what we want to have some confidence in knowing, is we can know when we latch on. We can know when we hold on and cling. We know when we feel tension or stress or suffering around any of these things. And some people I know, will, when the mind gets very quiet and they start feeling kind of a broad, spacious, open awareness, the attachment or the clinging they have is not to that, but to what they feel they're going to lose if they rest in that. If they rest in that, there's no kind of anchor in self in there. There's no like, you know, my usual self-identity is not operating in that spacious place. And you can feel that if you really give yourself over to this quiet spaciousness, the usual sense of self kind of wouldn't be there in the same way. And so the attachment, I can't go there. It's like, you know, that's frightening there and difficult. And so people pull back, pull away from it. Or it's so nice to go there because there's so little self there, so little of our problems in that space. So then people go and, you know, get attached to that. That's where you're supposed to be. Infinite consciousness. People give it great names. You know, it's good public relations to have good names. Cosmic consciousness. God consciousness. Wow, you can't get much better than those things. And so then, you know, that's it. You know, we want that. Hold on to that. So mindfulness practice is an attention, is like connected to awareness. And as we get more and more in the present moment, as we're more with our experience, not just with it, but we almost like be our experience, more we just hear and with our experience, mindful of our experience. As our normal chatter and surface chatter falls away and gets quieter, at some point, what tends to happen is that we start seeing that there's a distinction between what we know, what we experience, and our knowing of it. And as the knowing gets stronger, and as our attachment to things weakens, that distinction becomes stronger and stronger, until at some point, the knowing becomes more interesting, more predominant than the thing that we know. So, you know, there might be some candy in a bowl in front of me, and I'm capable of being so ravished or so out of sorts that, you know, I see the candy and next thing I know I've eaten it. You know, the candy is the world. You know, just, you know, there's awareness of candy. I mean, who wants to be aware of candy when you can eat it? So, you know, just the candy. But it's also possible to know there's candy there. And then it's possible to really know there's candy. It's possible to the knowing of the candy is there is so strong that you could say that you know that you know. You know that you know there's candy there. It's so clear that you know that you know that you know. This is special, though it sounds kind of complicated, right? But to have an awareness is strong enough that you, clearly you know that you know. Self-reflective awareness. So then the knowing becomes stronger. And at some point the knowing, or the awareness, whatever it is we have going on, becomes more interesting than the candy. It's like becomes bigger, more wonderful, more luminous, more satisfying, more peaceful, a greater sense of presence, greater sense of beingness. The knowing is like, wow, to know. It's kind of like those of you who have glasses maybe have this experience. Maybe if you know car, driving a car, it's similar. You know, you're driving and driving and driving, and you don't notice how the windshield is getting more and more dirty. And you're just kind of, you know, contently going along until someone cleans it, and you say, wow. That's happened with me and my glasses. So my wife says, Gil, I think we should clean your glasses. And she does, and wow, this is a luminous world. I had no idea. Or you know, where it's really smoggy or hazy, you know, and you see just what's around you. But at some point, you know, there's rain comes, the wind comes and blows all this smog away. And suddenly you see something that kind of is not really there. You see how clear the air is. But you can't really see the clear air, right? But you see but the air is clear. And it's so special. Wow, this is, and you kind of like, you're like, this is, you kind of look, and that becomes more interesting to see the clear and spacious air than the all, you know, the traffic and the billboards and other things in the city. So in the same way, the consciousness or knowing awareness can begin standing out in the highlight, and it can have some of those same qualities of a clear air day. You know, it's very clear, spacious, it's kind of empty, and very refreshing, peaceful. You can't quite see it, but you can see it, kind of like the air, you know, clear air. But it stands out in highlight, and it's very powerful to have this happen, because it can help shift our relationship with the objects of the world. And objects of the world means anything we can think, anything we can be aware of within us and outside of us. And it becomes like we realize there's a whole other game in town. If the only game in town is things, then the person who manipulates things the best wins. But there's a whole other game, and that's, there's awareness. It's like the other half. And most people know the half of life that has to do with things, object of thought, object of what we know. But the flip side, or the opposite, is the knowing that knows it. And when that stands out in the highlight, and you realize that that's the second game in town, then you don't have to invest all your eggs in the first game. Put down all your chips on that game. Save it for the, when you, you know. So this broad, you know, I don't know broad, but this, when the knowing is strong, and it's quite something to know, just the act of knowing and learning to have a sense that knowing is independent of what is known. And so you can know anything whatsoever, but you know you're independent of it. Another moment that was very important for me in Burma, practicing there, was it was kind of like it made me very happy. I understood at some point very clearly that, at least in theory, I could know anything, I could be mindful of anything that I experienced. There was nothing in the world of experience that I could not be mindful of. And that made me really happy, because then I knew I could be free in all, in any circumstance at all. That freedom was possible in any circumstance because I could be mindful of it. Because I had a clear sense that mindfulness itself, when it was strong, was a kind of freedom from, independent from what is known. And when that sense of consciousness or awareness or knowing feels like a form of wealth, a form of value, of something precious or satisfying, or feels vital and alive and pure and clear and peaceful and something, in a way that the objects, things of the world could never provide, it's very easy to get attached to that consciousness, to cling to that. That's what I want. That's it. But it can be very instructive to have that experience, because it begins to loosen up the entanglement we have with things in the world, with the things we want and things we're afraid of, things which we, you know, pushing away, and things we want, and everything has to be a certain way. And because we realize the heart can be at peace without the things in the world being the way we want or not want. So one thing I found very helpful was beginning to understand something about, at least how it works for me, the awareness. When awareness got kind of broad and spacious, expansive, and how, what it taught me about, when that I got preoccupied or got caught by something, that would get narrow again. And it's very hard to get caught or get caught up in some things, get entangled, get attached, if we stay relaxed and open. The broad, expansive mind is a relaxed mind. And so to feel the relaxation, to feel the openness, and feel how that relaxation is lost, the mental relaxation, this awareness relaxation, is lost by any kind of holding on or moving towards or attacking or pushing away or getting involved in. It's very instructive, because then you can start, if you see how that operates, the holding, the entanglement, the wanting and not wanting, and see the impact, the effect it has on you, then you can naturally kind of say, well, you know, I don't think this is so interesting. It's like they say that people pull their hands automatically away from a hot stove. Can be a little bit like that. You kind of see, why, if I have all this sense of well-being and happiness, why would I want to get all upset about that or get all attached with that? I lose something if I pick that up, if I get involved in that. Why would I? This is not to say that we don't, not involved in the world, but we can stay involved in the world without the entanglement with it, the attachment with it. So I'll ask you a question for you to not answer to me, but rather to feel your way into it, sense your way. How do you know that you're aware? As we're sitting here, just as we're just here, not remembering back into the past, but if you happen to be aware now, how do you know that you're aware? What's the evidence? Where do you find your awareness, your knowing? What is it to know right now? Not what you know, but what's it like to be knowing? What's it like to be aware of anything that's happening right now? One of the ways that the Buddha used the teachings on the aggregates was to help people not take any of the aggregates, or get attached to any of the aggregates as who they are. It's one of the primary forms of attachment, is attachment to self. To take your body as who you are, to take feelings as who you are, to take perceptions or mental formations or consciousness. There was a very strong tradition in India at the time of the Buddha that took consciousness as being the self. So if you take and clip your fingernail and have fingernail clippings on the bathroom's counter, and you look down at that fingernail clipping, is that you in that clipping? Where do you begin? Where do you end? Is that still you? Was that you and that fingernail clipping was still attached to your fingernail? Is your fingernail you? People spend a lot of time on their hair, a lot of money, some people on their hair. I'm amazed. It took me years to realize this, but now lately I'm noticing how many hair salons there are, beauty parlors, and how many people are doing their fingernails. I mean, I guess I lived a pretty protected life. And now that I walk around Redwood City, wow, there's another one. Another one. But is your hair really who you are? It was really who I was when I was 16, for sure. But is it really who you are? Your hair? So the Buddha, a number of times, guided people around these aggregates and these building blocks of their experience to understand that these things don't qualify, aren't really who we really are. And you can imagine as you do this, that there's a letting go, or a letting be, or a freeing up. Letting go and freeing up are kind of synonymous. So if you're attached to the fingernail clipping to be yourself, and then you let go of that as being you, there's also a freeing up that goes on there, a releasing. And you're not limited anymore by the definition the fingernail clipping is me. You're in trouble then if you flush it down the toilet. The fingernail, you know, just... So to let go is not like a bad news thing. It's like freeing up, releasing. So the Buddha did this thing where he guided people systematically. I kind of think it was like a guided meditation. To free themselves up from all the things that they could take, this is who I am. And for those who understand what these kind of guided meditations are like, that the Buddha, the guided instructions the Buddha gave, is they understood that when they finished this thing up, there was nothing in the world of experience that they could experience that was any more held onto as myself. Freed up from anything at all in the world of experience as being who I am, including the need to have anything be myself, be who I really am. There's no need to answer the question, who am I then? From not all these things, then who am I really? It's an unneeded question when you're free. And the Buddha provided no answers to that. He did not say there's no self. He did not say that there is a self. But he did say you could be free of seeing all these things as the self, as you. So it goes to take a lot of permission or be very creative around how the Buddha taught this, maybe. So what you see, the things that you see, are not you. That which you hear is not you. That which you smell is not you. That which you touch or feel with your body is not you. That which you taste is not you. Your hair is not you. Your fingernails are not you. Be free. Your face is not you. Set yourself free of your face. Your body is not you. Release yourself from your body. The feelings that you have are not you. You can let go of them being you. The things that you perceive and recognize are not you. Your thoughts are not you. Your desires and aversions are not you. Your memories are not you. You can be released of your memories. Your mental formations are not you. Your awareness is not you. Your concerns are not you. Your suffering is not you. The freedom from suffering is not you. Whatever it is you can know, that is not you. And whatever it is that you know, whatever you know is not you, you are free.